So I'm all for leverage. I'm just saying the cash flow from assisted living facilities that are run properly, when you have scaling, when you have the things that you need, because again, there's some challenges. When you get those things, it sometimes can make sense to do those things unlevered. And that's not true of very many other real estate subclasses.
Welcome to Passive Wealth Strategies for Busy Professionals. Today, our guest is Lo Hornbuckle. He is a residential assisted living investor. Today, we're going to talk about how you and others can do well while doing good by ethically investing in memory care residential assisted living facilities. In this discussion, we get a lot into the impact that a good residential assisted living operator can have on individuals, their residents, and their families, and on society at large. We get into the future of residential assisted living and how necessary it is going to continue to be, how much it's going to grow over the next decade to two decades as the baby boomer generation gets older and starts to use those services even more. This is a great discussion if you, again, want to learn about how you can do well with your investments while doing good for society and having a positive impact on those around you. Without further ado, here's Lo. Lo, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Happy to talk with you. We've been Facebook friends for a while, and I've been, you know, watching what you do and what you post online, and I was, you know, looking forward to talking with you. So, you know, do we want to start with Capital with a Cause? Do we want to start with your assisted living investments? Where is your priority right now?
Yeah, I mean, they're really interchangeable for me. I mean, I think, you know, some people may have more interest in the assisted living piece. Capital with a cause, is something that I think is just a natural pairing with raising capital for a business that helps people improve their health outcomes, improve their quality of life. So we can definitely start with the assisted living piece. And I know you've had others on the show talk about assisted living, so feel free to ask me oddball or more different questions so that you can kind of get a little bit different take on the topic.
Yeah, so I mean, we've talked about on the show, we had Gene Guarino on to talk about the residential assisted living business model, kind of at a high level. That was one of the early episodes. And you know, you're somebody who's out there doing it. So can you tell us more about the niche in residential assisted living that you invest in? Because even though it's a fairly specific investment, it has residential assisted living has some pretty distinct silos or business paths, business types within it. So what are you doing in residential?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is that, you know, I always kind of tell everybody, I don't think residential assisted living is a real estate business for most people. It can be, you know, if you buy a facility and then you lease it to an operator, then essentially you're in the real estate side of the business. But I think substantially a number of the profits that come from assisted living, really, it's a service business that has a real estate component, if that makes any sense. So the vast majority of the success or failure of the business is going to come from the operational side, not necessarily from the real estate piece. And so, you know, it's a very rewarding business. You can help a lot of people. It's also a difficult business. I mean, you're taking care of people 24 hours a day. You know, you've got staff. Healthcare workers are not the easiest to find in the world right now, especially in America. We have a shortage of healthcare workers. And so you're kind of at this point where, you know, there's some challenges to the business. Very rewarding. You definitely have moments where you're very, very happy that you got into the business because all the people you can help. There's also some periods of time where it can be stressful. And, you know, being in a healthcare related business, you know, that's open 24 hours definitely has its challenges. And so, you know, I'm always mindful to talk to people about that. If they're thinking about getting into the space, the best way to be involved, or one of the best ways to be involved, in my opinion, is to you can invest in other people that are doing all the hard work for you. So there's obviously opportunities to pick someone who's raising capital for their projects, and then you can give them capital and let them deal with the 3 a.m. phone calls and the no call, no shows from staff. Let that be their problem.
Oh man! All right. So yeah, I like the sound of that because you know I like investing in apartments and maybe things that are I don't know, less, I don't know, it's still important, but it's another level when you're taking care of grandma and grandpa. That is clearly at its own, you know, in terms of
investment. I've been in the multifamily business before. So there's definitely an operational level in multifamily. You know, a good property management company or a good management team is going to can improve properties that are a lot struggling. But if we're going to say that an apartment is 80% location, pricing strategy, and building, and 20% operations, assisted living is probably the reverse. So maybe it's 20% building, 80% operations. So there's definitely a big gap between the operational component of multifamily and there are assisted living or dementia care or something along those lines. So what it means is that the operational team takes that much more importance. You know, I've been in situations before where I bought a building that was empty and filled it in a couple of months. You know, built same building. I really did. I put maybe $10,000 in CapEx into a $1 million project. It wasn't a CapEx problem. It was an operator problem. And so, you know, you can have a good operations. You can definitely, you know, there's a lot of people in this business that get reputations for turnaround artists. They just go where the problem is and they go solve the problems. Because it's definitely it's a personality driven, build a good team, cast a compelling vision, and really understand what it is that your clients want and find a way to give it to them if you can.
Nice. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of upside when you can buy an underperforming asset and improve it. And as far as your specific work within residential assisted living, you work with dementia care.
Right now, 32 of the 40 beds that I have are licensed here. So I do a lot of teaching and coaching about dementia care all over the country. But I'm developing some mixed properties that have both assisted living and dementia care. So when those projects are done, my sort of bed mix will be closer to 50-50. I'll probably have, because my next couple projects are pretty big, they're kind of like 2/3 to 3/4 assisted living to dementia care. So that'll kind of even the numbers out. Or out of a couple hundred beds, I'll have about 100 and 100. So I really like what dementia care has to offer, but I think anytime you're in this space, if you can be more things to more people, you know, so having sort of a base model assisted living, having kind of a luxury assisted living, and then having kind of a dementia care product, it's good positioning in the marketplace because now you can capture, you know, budgets that range, you know, in a $2,000 range. You can capture people with, you know, different demographics, different needs. I mean, if you think about it, the really beautiful part about residential assisted living are these small, your ability to be able to change any one house to meet a niche. So, you know, if I'm well connected with a local synagogue, they say, man, we really love what you're doing. We need to coach your house. Can you do that? Well, they can, if they can fill the number of beds necessary to make it worthwhile, then we can certainly do that. That's an example, right? So you can have it be along any number of things you can think about. You know, maybe you do a house for people that have traumatic brain injuries and your average population is 30 or 40 years old. You know, right now you have people that, you know, are younger and get into a car accident and they go to a traditional rehab or traditional assisted living and they're looking around and the average age is 87. And they have a hard time relating. You know, if you're 27, you get in a motorcycle wreck, probably not going to, you know, enjoy being in a house with 15, 87 year olds. Maybe you will. Maybe you'll probably learn some stuff. But, you know, but it's good to have that choice. And so the cool thing about these smaller settings is that you can pivot very easily. You can rise to the occasion to meet different demands that are in the marketplace. Very difficult to do with a big building because if you build a 100-bed facility, you know, if you're going to go after a niche, it's got to be a really big niche in a market because 100 beds is totally different than filling 8 or 10.
Yeah. So I had never thought about the angle of, say, somebody that gets a young person that gets in a motorcycle accident might need to go to a memory care facility. That's a interesting point. I mean, from the outside, I wouldn't have thought about that, or the kosher house. I mean, again, would have never thought about that.
Well, and it's beyond just that. I mean, you think about, you know, what, you know, Jimmy Buffett's doing with Margaritaville. I mean, he's built an entire, you know, they're building a Margaritaville facility in Austin. It's going to be a bunch of people like listening to Jimmy Buffett all hanging out. You know, I mean, you could do this. I mean, the other day I was telling the story to somebody and they said, you know what I've always wanted to do? I've always wanted to become college alumni. So, you go to a college town and you build an assisted living facility that's Penn State centric or University of Michigan centric or University of Texas centric, you know, and so you can, and if you think about it, a lot of times we'll compare assisted living to sort of dormitory style living for seniors. So that's a great, you know, it's like we're back in college again, you know, everything's centered around games. I mean, it's just the possibilities are endless. It really all boils down to first key is, you know, what's your marketing situation? You know, who do you have the intention of? Who do you have influence over and who they have influence? And if you find that you have, you know, if there's one or two people in the entire city that control most of the traumatic brain injury cases and they're struggling to find a place to go, if you appeal to that person and can cast a unique selling proposition, then you can certainly do that. So the possibilities are endless. You can do it around, you know, you could do it around, you know, country of origin. You know what? We're going to have a house that serves all Korean food and gets the newspaper in Korean. You know, the thing I like about this business and what's really powerful about it is that you can, if you focus on service and you're creative enough, then you can basically always make yourself unique. Your uniqueness is limited only to your imagination and to what exists in the marketplace. You know, and the college town idea was kind of amusing to me because if you think about most major cities, they'll have a sports bar that's themed for a team not representing the local city. So if you go to Philadelphia, there's going to be a Dallas Cowboys sports bar where Dallas Cowboy fans can go to a bar and enjoy the game and not listen to Eagles fans. No offense to you Eagles fans. Y'all are kind of annoying. I'm sure there's some listeners in Philadelphia. And I'm sure you think we're annoying too, and that's fine. That's how sports work. But if you think about that, like think about like you could have a Texas A&M alumni in Austin. Right. So the point is that you can really, anything you can carve out in the space, you can do because there's people that need care. There's people that have needs. And if you can build a lifestyle around that care, you can do that. Dementia care, if you really think about it, is just a subset of that. Right. So there's assisted living needs, that's general population. And there's people that have cognitive impairment. Now, dementia, there's 105 different types of dementia. So or like 110. Wow. There's a lot of them. We only really talk about like five or six because that's vast majority of cases, but you could have a particular house that's really well specialized in treating people that have the symptoms of Lewy body dementia. So, and your caregivers know what it looks like and they know what to expect because people that have impulse control versus someone that has memory issues versus someone that's totally docile and sort of has more forgetfulness, those people are not going to necessarily be treated the same way. And we've not right now, we have them all in kind of one community under the umbrella term memory care, dementia care. So it's interesting to think about that you can take this to a place where you can get really, really detailed if you want to. And that's really powerful in any business because, you know, you can appeal to whatever the market says you should appeal to. And you just have to understand it and you have to have connections in that marketplace. It's a very powerful place to be and you could also pivot. I mean, just imagine you're running along, you're doing assisted living for 10 years, and let's say they start building a bunch of assisted living facilities around you. You start maybe having less, more and more competition, and you start struggling more and more to maintain your census. Nothing stops you from spending a little bit of money, redoing the house in a certain theme, and then using that as a unique selling proposition and going after the people that are Rolling Stones fans. For example.
Rolling Stones fans. Yeah, those Rolling Stones fans really are getting up there in years.
No, I'm just
the Rolling Stones themselves are getting up there in their years. But yes, I mean, you can obviously see, I mean, I'm using a lot of real specific examples because the point I want to make is that again, your unique selling, it's one of the few industries where your unique selling proposition is limited only to your imagination. There's just only so many other businesses that are like that. And this very cool thing about this business, you know, I mean, and you can find something you're into. I mean, you know, I know how many people that are older knit. I'm not into knitting, but I mean, if I hired a caregivers that were into knitting and if I hired, you know, managers that understood the knitting market, then we can have a house that turns out awesome things for grandkids every day. You know what I'm saying? Like you can do that. So that's the really cool thing about it is as long as you can understand that niche, you can speak to it.
Are you a real estate investor looking to earn more money in less time? We've compiled the 5 things holding you back in real estate in a quick 2-page document, which you can get for free by texting real estate to 31996. That's 2 words. Text real estate to 31996. To learn the top 5 things holding you back as a real estate investor, text real estate to 31996.
So I think one of the, from the passive investing standpoint, one of the struggles that a lot of people have when they're looking for assisted living opportunities, residential assisted living opportunities, is just getting in the first place. Because if you're out there trying to passively invest in real estate right now, we'll stick with the real estate example, even though residential assisted living by your description is not necessarily real estate investing. If you want to invest in multifamily right now, you can go find a multifamily syndicator pretty easily. Whereas residential assisted living, from my perspective, it's a little bit harder to find those people. You guys are just quieter, I think is what it is. But where are the, say, where are the good residential assisted living syndicators right now? You're raising your hand on the live stream. But broadly, I mean, where can we find you guys? Where are you hanging out? Where can we meet you? Where do we meet the best ones?
So one of the things that attracted me about assisted living initially, and I'll answer your question in a second, I haven't forgotten it. One of the things that attracted me about assisted living in the first place was I thought this is my one chance in life to not follow a trend, but be ahead of it. You know, I'm always, you know, I'm always the guy. So, and a lot of times in real estate, I think I was accidentally dumb money. A lot of times I'd always let something happen for 2 or 3 years and I would come in at the tail end, you know, and I think a lot of people do that, right? So the sort of most investors invest at the end of a cycle, you know, and then they get beat down, and it's the ones that have vision and courage that are investing in the depths of recessions and problems. And so right now, assisted living really, I mean, people talk about the baby boomers and the silver tsunami, all those things. Well, the oldest baby boomer is 74, right? 74, 75. The average person that lives in assisted living is 87. So baby boomers are not really interacting with assisted living yet. They're not really a part of the story. And so you're really able to be ahead of a trend. And so one of the reasons why I decided to really focus hard on becoming an operations company is the very thing you mentioned. I don't know of many people personally that are both working on operations and also in the capital raising side. They're almost always completely firewalled or two separate companies or whatever the case may be. We're kind of a unicorn in that capacity. Now, we're not saying they aren't out there. It's just, it's not a lot of people that are doing development and raising capital and doing operations. So the interesting thing is that we're in the process of building that out. So Gene and I are working together on a company called Family Legacy Homes. And the goal of that company will be to create a fund that will essentially raise investor money, and then we'll fund projects that we deem worthy. And obviously Gene, with his access to students and, you know, can spend a lot of time with these people, you know, gets an opportunity to vet people in a way that's hard to replicate, at least organically. So that's one thing that's kind of happening. I mean, I think the other thing is that assisted living is not very old. And assisted living started in 1983. So it's a new business. Residential assisted living, strangely, probably predates assisted living, because if you think about it, people used to board and care homes back in the day, you know, around for a long time, you know. So if a woman, you know, got widowed and she found herself in this home, you know, one of the ways she might make money is she would have strangers come in, either bed and breakfast style, or if someone was sick, come live in her home and help take care of them. That's a model that's been around for, you know, I don't know how long, but for probably hundreds of years, maybe thousands. So residential assisted living, as it's been created, is kind of an old business, but it's kind of coming around again. And I think the idea of making residential care homes into a business that you can scale and you can run like a business, in which you're able to do a great job taking care of your customers, but also create a big enough company where it can run in the background and it's not owner-centric, I think that's relatively new. And so I think that you're going to really see all that stuff start to change. One of the reasons why, you know, I've sort of gotten into my focus now is on planned care home communities. Some people call them a cluster development. But I like planned care home communities because I can have all of the scaling of a big building with 80 or 90 beds and all the things that comes with that, but I can avoid all the negative outcomes of long hallways, cafeteria style dining, non-home like feel, and I can create small intimate atmospheres, but all on one campus. The advantages of that dual model is multiple. And one of the number one things that really we're working to solve is in a campus design, I can have something that is very difficult in residential assisted living. It's very easy for me to get access to financing. So if you go to a bank for residential assisted living, sometimes they say, hey, is this a house? Is it a business? you know, do you have a track record, and kind of go through that dance. When you're doing a campus, it definitely is going to trade exactly the same as a big building would, right? Because it's a, you know, it's multiple communities on one campus. So now all of a sudden you get access to more traditional commercial financing. It, you know, now when your deal trades in the marketplace, it might trade at a 7 or 8 cap, whereas residential assisted living might trade at a 15. So you can kind of see how it might be advantageous from a disposition point of view to sort of develop enough scaling that you can solve those problems. And truthfully, when big money wants to get into this space, and, you know, it's always pouring in, but let's be honest, the amount of money that's going to flow into senior housing in the next 10 to 20 years is going to be very big. And the bigger you are, if you have 1,000 beds or 1,500 beds or 2,000 beds, you know, you're not necessarily having to look for them. They're looking for you because they say, hey, we know of this company that owns, controls 2,000 beds. Let's give them a call. And so your exits become a lot different. And those big companies, those big, you know, insurance companies and hedge funds and private equity groups, they can afford to overpay because they have access to cheap capital. They have access to systems and processes and teams. And so they usually come in and they usually pay over market value for something because they make it up on operational efficiency. And we saw that happen in single family homes. You know, we saw everyone, you know, all these hedge funds say, we don't know how to manage single family homes. We don't know how to manage single family homes. And all of a sudden they said, you know what? We got it figured out. We're just going to go buy 2,000 of them in a marketplace. And so we saw a lot of that. And you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, we saw that kind of consolidation where you had, you know, these hedge funds being the number one landlord in different cities and obviously being the number one landlord all over the country. So I think that's where assisted living's headed. I think there's going to be some consolidation, smaller levels, and I think you're going to see. And what's interesting is every business that seems to have this baby boomer relationship has been going through consolidation. People think about assisted living. I have this conversation with a friend of mine where he doesn't think that care homes can scale. Think about mom and pop pharmacies. They've been getting bought up and consolidated. Mm-hmm. Think about mom and pop funeral homes bought up and consolidated. There's very few standalone funeral homes anymore. They keep the family name, but they're owned by big corporations. So there's all these businesses that have been sort of mom and pop style operations, funeral homes. I think assisted living is sort of a natural evolution of that. And so my anticipation is you're going to see money kind of pour into assisted living. So it's definitely a good time to get into that space because, you know, if you're the gatekeeper and you hold inventory when the market decides that it's time to invest in something, that's a very powerful place to be.
Yeah. And you're not just holding this inventory and sitting on it. It's very much a cash flowing business. So you're making money just for the pleasure of holding the business in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about assisted living that's kind of fascinating is there are some assisted living projects that I've seen that make sense unlevered.
Wow.
I mean, think about how many apartments would trade without leverage. I mean,
none.
It's very few. None. It's not none, but it's close. And I mean, there's not many people going, you know what, let me go find something I can buy for $20 million and I can get, you know, 6% cash on cash. It's just not, people aren't putting $20 million in like that. All the returns are based on being levered. And I've seen care home deals that put $1 million in and make $150,000 a year. So you can maybe make the case that makes sense. Now, obviously, if you use leverage, then you can make those returns higher. So I'm all for leverage. I'm just saying the cash flow from assisted living facilities that are run properly, when you have scaling, when you have the things that you need, because again, there's some challenges. When you get those things, it sometimes can make sense to do those things unlevered. And that's not true of very many other real estate subclasses. Very few. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. There's going to be cash flow opportunities. There's going to be all kinds of stuff. There's obviously all the tax benefits of owning real estate, all the things associated with that. But for me, I think the really interesting thing about the business, like I'm doing the business because I like helping people. I like the challenge. I like helping improve people's situations where they've been in these situations where they're so terrible and they think, you know, my life is over. Don't know what I'm going to do. Mom or dad keeps falling. I can't get my life back. And we can solve that for them. It's a very powerful place to be in. The interesting thing about this business from a financial perspective is what it looks like in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. We're not even scratching the surface of what this business is going to look like. And the retirement of the baby boomers and the baby boomers shifting into assisted living have already caused wholesale changes globally And when they start interacting with assisted living and skilled nursing and memory care, man, I mean, it's hard to imagine, generations so much bigger than the previous one.
Yeah, it's going to change things a lot. I mean, one of my uncles is retiring in a month and he's 60.
And he's a baby boomer, maybe 61. I'm not exactly certain.
So he'll start interacting at some point with independent living or active adult, if potentially is what he may. And, you know, those communities right now are sort of having to answer the question of like, are baby boomers different? What do they want? You know, apparently they don't like the word senior. There's this whole like conversation about branding in our space. The business that I'm in, I'm in the business of helping people that basically have to do something. This is not necessarily a want transaction. This is I can't be safe at home. I can't meet my needs at home. I have cognitive impairment. My family can't take care of me. And so it's a little bit different because they're not making a decision out of a want. They're making a decision out of need, and they're picking the place they think is going to best meet those needs. That's very different than someone that's 65 and says, I want to play golf and be with my friends, so I need to find a community that checks off all my boxes. Very different process. The buyer timeline is very different. You know, most independent living transactions, I think they like take like 6 months to 2 years on average, you know, just because you have to court them and they got to make sure you like them. And, you know, do you have a buy-in? Do you own the real estate? Do you rent the real estate? Those are all components that they're grappling with. My business, it's a very quick turnaround. People are usually making a decision within 2 weeks because they're getting out of rehab and they've got to find a place to stay. They've done something unsafe at home. Their family is totally worn out and exasperated. I mean, a lot of times what my business is about is taking care of the resident. That's of course number one, but really what we're doing is we're giving the family their life back because, you know, kids are happy to help take care of their parents, but they've also probably got kids of their own. They've got their own life. They need some help. And in the case of cognitive impairment or dementia, they're probably not qualified to interact with that person. They don't know how to get past all their, you know, when you're taking care of someone that you know very well and has memory loss, you can personalize a lot of things that aren't personal. You know, it's not like if they love you enough, they're going to remember you. It's not how that works. But people think that. People think, oh yeah, he knows it's me because he loves me. Well, no, that's if his brain, her brain is dying or dead in the area of memory, then it doesn't matter how much they love you. They're not being agitated to you because they don't love you. They have a medical condition. And so it's sometimes best if you can kind of create arm's length, take care of someone that has massive cognitive impairment, because it's just really hard not to bring your baggage to the table.
Mm. Yeah. And I can see what you're saying about this is going to be, what would you call it? A silver wave, or this is going to be a big, silver tsunami. That's even bigger. But it's also interesting to hear you point out they have baby boomers have different preferences than the last generation. And specifically, they don't like the word senior. And I'm sure it gets far more detailed as to how these businesses need to market themselves to their residents. And then also, in many cases, I can imagine folks with cognitive impairments, you know, like you said, you're giving the family their life back. Essentially, you're marketing to the family, and you're also serving the family in addition to serving the resident. So how does that serving the family aspect impact your business and how you market it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I would say the vast majority of the decisions, probably somewhere around 90%, are made for someone and not with them. Meaning that very few of the residents in our case actually tour the facility they're going to move into. Rather, it's their power of attorney, whether that be a family member or a guardian, or, you know, sometimes people, you know, are 85 years old and they don't have a family. And so it's their next door neighbor or their old high school friend that's helping them. I mean, you see all kinds of unusual configurations, and, you know, it's great that someone's willing to help them. But bottom line is the vast majority of our transactions are made and done for by the family. So one of the things I really train my team is we have to be very careful because we catch people in moments of grief. You know, that happens often. We catch people in extreme moments of guilt. You know, I wasn't adequate enough to take care of my mom or dad or my spouse, and I have to put them in a home. A lot of guilt with that. We catch people in various states of denial. You know, someone might have a mom or dad that's 105, and they're they're approaching the situation like they're going to live another 30 years. You know, I mean, it could. I mean, but it's not necessarily likely. And so we see a lot of different states. And sometimes people see people that are just as rational and as just clear-eyed about a situation as you possibly can be. But that's rare. I mean, most people that we run into, most of our clients are going through various stages of grief, guilt, and denial. And so a lot of what we have to try to do is just try to set realistic expectations, give them permission. You know, sometimes we spend a lot of time giving, you know, there's been tours where I spent maybe 15, 20 minutes talking with the resident, another hour was talking about the wife who was upset. I mean, spouses are tough if you really think about it. I mean, you've lived with someone for 50, 60, 70, in some cases 80 years in terms of our clients. You've been with them. I mean, people are like, hey, we've never been apart for more than 3 days for the last 80 years.
Wow.
Like, and that happens. And then you sort of have this, you know, and it's less true now, but in, you know, 1940s, 1950s, you have really clearly defined gender roles. So you've got, you know, a woman who's like, I don't know how to balance our checkbook. I don't even know how much money we have. And on the flip side, you have a guy, he's like never done anything for himself except go out and have a job. And he's never done anything domestically. He couldn't tell you how to turn on the oven, for example. And so you have these people that have been in these relationships, so these very, very silo gender roles in a lot of cases, and they've been in these relationships for 80 years. And while I don't want to use the word codependency in terms of like a psychological term of baggage, they have very much become dependent on each other. And so that's why you see these crazy situations where, you know, people been together, you know, for 80 years and spouse one passes away and the other spouse follows in 3 days. You see a lot of that stuff. And so spouses can be very tricky to deal with, just because, again, they're bringing a lot of this stuff to the table. And so our job is to really understand it, not judge it in any stretch of the imagination, but just understand what they're going through and then kind of give them permission that it's okay. You know, it's okay that you have no training for taking care of someone with dementia and you feel like you've failed them. You haven't failed them. You've done that. You've been doing this a lot of times for 5, 6, 7, 10, 12 years. You've done a great job, but it's okay to take a step back because there's some decent data to indicate that if you take care of somebody with dementia, you usually die first.
Wow.
So, wow. You know, so there's a lot of people that pass away giving so much of themselves, you know, because if you're constantly in a state of stress, if you're constantly, your body's constantly in fight or flight, you're always worried about something, can't go on vacation, can't work your job, you're just dedicated your entire life. I had a guy that he trained himself to be a light sleeper. So every time his wife got up in the middle of the night, he could wake up with her. So he would routinely not get more than an hour and a half of sleep in a row where some noise or some sound or some worry wasn't causing him to wake up. And, you know, I mean, you know, that guy still had guilt. I'm like, man, you've been very dedicated, man. I mean, it's okay to let somebody, you know, take the wheel for you from time to time.
Yeah, you're not Superman. And
well, and it's very ingrained in this generation, right? It's a silent generation. You know, so there's a lot of expectation for people to suffer in silence.
Yeah.
We're very, you know, first step to get help is you're going to ask for it.
I mean, this is very much a business that impacts everybody, and you mentioned the siloed gender roles, particularly of a, you know, particular generation. I think, you know, the way I relate to that, and I encourage everybody there to think about it for yourselves. My grandfather passed away earlier this year. He was 92. He lived a great long life. He was very active up until literally the month that he passed away. But in a way, my grandmother's still alive. In a way, you know, the gender roles that they lived within, she took care of the cooking and the cleaning, and he took care of taking care of the farm and going out and making the money. And then he retired and everything. But if she had passed away first, and she's still alive, thankfully she's doing well. But if she had passed away first, he would not have been able to take care of himself in many ways. He doesn't know how to cook anything. He didn't know how to do a lot of those things. So somebody would have had to, one of my aunts and uncles would have had to step up and help take care of him in that situation. And I'm sure for folks listening, we're live streaming on Facebook, and I've seen some of my friends, you know, tune in and watch. And one of them in particular, her mother-in-law had dementia, and they were taking care of her up until, you know, she passed away. And it's a terrible situation. This impacts everybody. And this is a way of investing and and truly, and making money for sure, but it's a way of having an impact in society and having an impact on individuals' lives. So, you know, it's definitely, it's got a lot of appeal from my perspective, but for a lot of people. And, you know, I know you've got an initiative going on, Capital with a Cause. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that and specifically what you're doing to make an impact and, I don't know, change the equation a little bit, but what does that mean to you and what are you doing with Capital with a Cause?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, you know, at my core, you know, I believe that of all the economic systems and all the motivating factors in human society, that capitalism plays an important part in that. And that's what I believe in my core. And I think sometimes it can get a little bit flawed, and sometimes it can go to an extreme. So, for example, you know, if you're an assisted living operator and you don't have good motivations, and you're like, we got to get the net operating income up. Well, you can cut expenses. Well, what can we cut? Well, let's serve lower quality food. Well, let's cut back on the staff. So we really feel like we need, you know, three caregivers during the day, but let's cut to one and, you know, we'll make it work for a little while. Well, we got to have a mission that understands why you shouldn't do that. Now, you know, obviously capitalists would argue, hey, if you do that, then you'll go out of business. Well, that's probably true, but we see countless examples where people's motivations and incentives sometimes can be a bit short-sighted. You know, behavior theory tells us a lot about a person. You know, if great study, or they did some research about this factory, and if something coming down a factory line is cancerous but not hot to the touch, they struggle to get workers to wear gloves because it's not hot, and so they just don't think they need to wear them. On the other side, if something's not dangerous at all but it burns your hand or is cold to the touch, it's very easy to get workers to wear gloves. Well, if something's hot or cold, you're probably going to burn the outside layer of your skin. But if you handle something for 20 years in the factory, that's going to give you cancer, much worse result. So behavioral theory, we know, doesn't really weight the long term as well as it should have. It's the reason why people struggle to eat well and exercise and all those things. Short term pleasure is part of the deal. So sometimes as a CEO or as a, you know, someone running a company, you can sometimes get so focused on, I got to make this quarter. And when you're talking about taking care of people, you have to have a strong why. And so Capital with a Cause for me was really all about kind of marrying the idea that you don't have to squeeze every dollar out of every situation and then take whatever's left over and invest it in charity. You can combine the two and you can create situations where your investments or the things you're investing in create positive things for other people. So, and if you can marry those two causes, you have, you know, what's called impact investing. You can make an impact. And impact investing can be things like sustainable agriculture. It could be, you know, in my case, investing in assisted living to where you can improve the outcomes and the quality of life for people that are, you know, especially memory care folks are very vulnerable members of society that can't be their own advocate. So if you can marry investing, making a return, but also creating a positive return inside society, that's what Capital with a Cause is all about. And frankly, I'd heard of impact investing before, but I'd always kind of been too much of a capitalist in terms of just being focused on what's the money look like. And as I got into this business, totally changed me because I realized you can't always be focused on the money. You have to consider your residents. You have to consider your staff, sometimes even at the expense of money. And so I had a couple of investors when I was initially raising capital for the first time, and they would tell me like, hey, you know, I have other deals that I can invest in, but I'm investing in your deal because I think it's going to be beneficial for these people and I can tell you really care about them. And I had one guy, he said to me, he said, listen, I one time lost $100,000 drilling for oil. I did not feel good about losing that money. He said, if I give you this $100,000 and I lose the money, I hope you don't lose it. But if you do, I'll at least feel like I was trying to help some people in the process. So I started to realize that wasn't anything I came up with. My investors were just telling me, hey, we do care about your mission. We do care about what we're trying to do. And so it made me realize that I want to create a forum and I want to create a place. And so we're kind of working on building this group where people that have deals that have a social component to them can invest with investors who are not going to just invest in deal B because the IRR is 2% higher, right? They may say, hey, listen, deal A might have a 2% lower internal rate of return, but I think you're going to positively impact the community. I think you're going to positively impact people that are in difficult situations. And so for that reason, I'm going to invest, because my spirit gets lifted by doing those things. The community gets made better off. Or, you know, I know what I went through when my grandfather had dementia. I know what I went through when my spouse had assisted living needs. And I saw the struggles, and I saw the isolation and the depression, and I saw what happened, how deadly falls can be. So if you can do something that can help prevent that in another family and save them from that pain, then your investment makes more sense to me than a couple points. And so that's really where that's kind of been born from, is the idea that, you know, it's not all about how much money you make. It's a combination of making money and doing good for society, kind of do good and do well at the same time.
I like that. I like that a lot. I mean, this is an important cause, and you know, you said it without saying the specific term, but the one that comes to mind to me is, you know, senior abuse. It's out there. It's real. People are doing it, and it's tragic. So, I don't know what else to say other than that. So, certainly, I applaud you for doing what you're doing. Yeah, appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I, what I always say about that is most of the time people get into these situations or neglect. Listen, it doesn't matter how good of a facility you have, it can happen, period. And I try not to wag my finger at anybody that, you know, some other facility has. Where I do think it's really important is that where people get into trouble, and where I do wag my finger at them, is that when something becomes clear, they don't take action as a company. Or, you know, famously, there's an old saying, it's not the act that gets you, it's the cover up. You know, it's people that have bad things happen, they don't own it. You know, and so, you know, our company is based on the premise that we're going to make mistakes. You're taking care of someone 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Just go ahead and understand you're going to make mistakes. And I got a couple of people on my staff who are dyed-in-the-wool perfectionists. And I'm like, listen, guys, you have to understand, if we put out a bad meal, if we do a poor job cooking a meal and the residents don't like it, or the family says, hey, they didn't like it, it wasn't a very tasty meal, you apologize, fix it to the best of your ability, and work on systems and process to improve it. Because there are, you know, places all over the country that are charging more money and serving rice and beans as the only meal all day, every day, and the caregivers are uninterested, and all those things. So to me, it's less about, you know, things like senior abuse and more like apathy. You know, there are a lot of people that get in this business and their residents are numbers on a spreadsheet, not people. And I try to stay as connected to that part as possible so that I can see the families for who they are. I can understand their stories for what they are. You know, I mean, just imagine if people bring, you know, their life story with them. One of the most interesting things I've ever had happen, and it was a paradigm shifting thing for me, was I had this person whose family had, I forget which country, but their family had survived sort of a communist famine. And so she just assumed anytime someone ate like a smallish meal, it like set her off, because it would take her down this, oh, he's going to starve to death. And we serve relatively small meals in assisted living. Meals are good, but they're small. Most seniors, you know, like, you know, you or I may eat a 10-ounce steak. Most seniors need 2, 3 ounces, 4 ounces of a steak. That's what they're actually going to eat. And so for her, she had convinced herself that these small meals. And so, you know, we were like, man, what is she talking about? And then when I sat down and I heard her story, it all made sense. Because, I mean, just imagine you see your family members go through, or you hear these stories going through your family about the famine and starvation, and then your husband moves into an assisted living facility that's serving a standard style meal. You're like, oh my God, they're serving prison-sized food here. And we're like, no, okay. So what you're saying really is you want him to have bigger portions. So easy to fix, but we didn't need to understand her story because we needed the context behind how she was feeling. And so we try to take the time to figure that out and realize that, you know, great book that I read about psychology, a friend of mine wrote it, Doctor of Psychology. It basically just as of the theory that everybody's doing the best they can with the tools and that they have. So there's very few people in the world that are just evil. They're not. They're making the decisions that they think make sense in the context of what they think is going on. And if you can understand that, then you can kind of appreciate people for who they are. and just understand that, like, listen, if I'd gone through the experiences you had, I might have a different outlook on life as well. And so that's a, you need that for two reasons. Number one, you have to have that when you deal with people with dementia and memory loss and all those things, because, you know, they're, you've got to get in their world. They're never going to come to yours. You have to be able to understand what they're actually thinking. You know, if you've got a guy that every day packs a suitcase to leave, an untrained person says, where are you going? You're not going anywhere. You live here. Go put your stuff away. Well, now you've got a cognitively aware adult arguing with a person that has a brain disease. Which one's crazy? You tell me. Now, a trained person says, hey, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to school. Awesome. What day are you going to school? I'm going today. What day do you think it is? It's Tuesday. Well, you're going to school tomorrow. So I have an idea. Since you're going to school tomorrow, it doesn't make sense to leave your luggage out by the front door because someone could trip over it. Take it back to your room, and I'll remind you tomorrow when the bus comes. Treat that process as needed. So you can understand why accepting people for who they are is a very important part of assisted living and dementia care, because you've got to get in their world. They're never going to come to yours. And that's not true of families, but it can be. You know, if you bring 80 years of a personal story and baggage with you, you know, emotional trauma and fears and pain and pleasure, there's very little I'm going to be able to do to fix that in a month or two. So, you know, I've got to kind of understand where you're coming from, figure out what your goals and expectations are, and then do the best I can to build my company and my service around those needs for you. And if I can't, I'll tell you, then go try to find the company that can.
Wow. Quite the example that you gave of the gentleman that you're packing his bag and leaving it by the door, and, you know, how a trained person handles it. So we had a question here on the live stream that I want to make sure to get to. It's very different from what we've been talking about, but it's right along your lines of experience. So let's get into it. So the question is from someone who's sourcing deals. How can we find local operators if we have a perfect house to sell or rent to them for an assisted living operation?
Yeah, so that's a good question. You know, I don't think it's as easy. You know, most cities do have, you know, groups of people that are in assisted living space, and there are plenty of people that rent their homes. You know, I've always kind of been of the opinion, I'd like to be on both sides. I want to be the real estate owner, operator. And the biggest challenge, so I don't know that I have a great answer for that question specifically. I think that's just networking. My suspicion is that the person you're probably going to find is going to be someone that doesn't come from a real estate background, but rather comes from I'm a social worker, I'm a nurse, or I've been an administrator, and I've wanted to own my own business for a long time. And so I'm going to do something that's not as capital intensive. Leasing obviously is less capital intensive. One thing I will give them a piece of advice for is just be prepared. Most of the work is in the operations. So be prepared that whatever structure you enter in with them, you know, just like if you hire a third party management company, say multifamily versus assisted living, in a big assisted living, the operator gets a much bigger piece of the pie. They're often required to personally guarantee debt. As the operator, you know, most assisted living deals, the operator may get points on the deal because they're doing all the hard work and they're dealing with all the challenges of business. So it's a bit different. So obviously seek to the best advice I can give you is if you do find somebody, ask good questions about what they want, what their goals are, and then try to do something, try to create a lease agreement or terms that create win-wins so that you can understand what they want. I think too many people come from a background of, okay, well, this is the way single family works, this is the way multifamily works. And if you do it that way, you're very likely to make a deal that either doesn't pass a smell test for a good operator, or the only person that would say yes to it is an operator that doesn't know any better, and you might be inadvertently taking advantage of them, or you might be basically self-selecting that you only get bad operators because, you know, a good operator is worth their weight in gold and can get a deal anywhere. If someone can fill and operate an assisted living facility or memory care facility, they can do anything they want within reason because they're very hard to find. There might be, like, for example, Texas Organization of Residential Care Homes, TORCH, and it's a state organization that has local chapters. If you can find if there's some sort of assisted living association or residential assisted living association, and they have meetings you can join, then you can, you know, basically say, you know, I have a house that I think would be perfect, and I'd love to hire an operator. So it's really going to be come back to just good old-fashioned networking and figuring out who the right people are to know. I don't know that there's another good way to do it.
Oh, networking is a
great skill.
Yeah, okay, this is one thing. Most states do tell you where the licensed facilities are. So what you could do is you could go get a list of all the licensed facilities, and most states require you to list who owns the real estate and who the operator are, and you can look for pretty obvious differences in companies. That could be a clue, or you could, and then what you're doing is you're calling them to say, hey, I'm looking for an operator to take over this project. Would you be interested in leasing or coming to be third-party management? You could call all the existing operators in a certain area and ask them. So I get calls often from, hey, you know, I got this house to sell, or I found you because I went to the list on Texas and I'm just calling. So it's a little bit more targeted cold call, if you were. So you're not calling the phone book, you're just calling people that have a decent reason to be in this.
Nice. Okay. I like that. We're going to take a quick break for our sponsor.
Want daily interviews with real estate investors and none of the fluff? Go to bestevershow.com, where Joe Fairless interviews daily real estate investors and entrepreneurs about their best advice ever. Go to bestevershow.com.
What is the best investment in real estate that you've ever made?
Definitely the first care home that I built. It was an awesome deal, and not only did I learn a whole lot, but just really, really outstanding returns, and that's been an awesome project.
Okay. Second question. What is the worst investment that you ever made?
This one's also pretty obvious for me. My partner and I in Louisiana bought 30 low-income houses. Man, class C and D, or E maybe in some cases, class C, E, single family investing, is difficult business. We worked real, real hard to break even most months in that business. So definitely our low income Louisiana portfolio was definitely the worst investment we ever made.
Yeah. I mean, I can see in that business, you have low rents, but a lot of your costs for equipment and things, I mean, they're going to be fixed. An AC unit costs what an AC unit costs, no matter where you are. So you need to have enough gross rents to have enough rent left over after you pay your debt to pay for your, I don't know, new AC unit, to keep going with my example, or any of that equipment, stuff like that.
I mean, I can deal with that, but I mean, the stuff that always bothered me was just, you know, I think sometimes too, people are kind of on the margins society financially. You'll see situations where you'll have a 4-bedroom house with one bathroom or something, you know, because that's just how you know, it's not a great way to do it. And you don't have 8 adults in the house, and you're just going to, whether you have no bad intents at all, you're just going to destroy the house. It's just not, you know, eight adults sharing the space of that size, using one restroom, just going to predictably cause a lot of unnatural wear and tear to the property. So it was definitely eye-opening, learned a lot from that. Definitely learned a lot about my investment philosophy when it came.
Good to know. Last question, my favorite one. What is the most important lesson you've learned in investing?
So that's interesting. I think for me, it's really to invest in what you know in. So I think anytime you can sit down or talk to clients that you more intuitively understand, because that's your background, or that's your income level, or you're talking to clients where you're speaking the same vernacular, you know, it's always helpful, you know. So if you're an educated person, if you can somehow create situations where the person on the other side of the desk with you is an educated person, you've just got a real good way with country people, then probably interacting with people from the country is going to work out really well for you. And so I think for me, it's invest in things that you know, and invest in things that you can intuitively understand because you've spent time with them. You know, if you're scared of water, probably don't invest in island vacation homes because you don't really understand the lifestyle. Right? So I just recommend people to invest in things they understand. That's been helpful for me is when I can invest in things where I can really understand the clientele because I've gone through the same thing, or because they remind me of my family or whatever, that can allow me to be more effective with my clients, and as opposed to not really understanding the conditions that someone's going through on the other side of the table.
So I appreciate everything today on residential assisted living, particularly the memory care. It's definitely compelling, and I think you have a great angle on it or a great way of looking at the business. So, you know, I appreciate you sharing that and being out there. If folks want to learn more, if they're interested in passively investing, where can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and one thing, you know, if your family, if you're looking for something for your family, you know, and you're in a different state or city, you know, feel free to reach out to me. I'll try to connect you to resources, just, you know, investing related. You know, if you just need to talk about assisted living here, you know, feel free to give me an email. But best way to find me is my email is L-O-E, my first name, Lo. And then my website is at the, T-H-E, Sage, S-A-G-E, O-A-K.com. Or you can go to thesageoak.com. There's an info tab. You can click that and that'll come right to me. And people can get information about either investing in or how to start a residential assisted living. I connect you to some resources there. Or if you just, you know, hey, I'm trying to find a place for my mom in Kansas City, you know, give me a call. And if I got somebody in my network, I'll refer you.
Very cool. Well, once again, I appreciate you taking some time to talk to us and being out there and being a force for good in the world.
Hey, man, really appreciate having me on the show. It was a lot of fun.
Hey, it was my pleasure. To everybody out there, thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. If you are enjoying the show, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It's a big help. It helps other people learn about the show. If you know someone that could use some passive wealth in their lives, please share the show with them and bring them into our little tribe of investors. Once again, thank you for tuning in. I hope you have a great rest of your day and a great week, and we will talk to you on the next one. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir.